Hello and welcome to Radio Retail, with me, your host, William Madison. This week on the podcast, we'll be talking about the much-anticipated employment bill with two experts in the field on what the new legislation will mean for retailers. But first, everyone has been truly shocked by the scale of the human tragedy in Ukraine over the past few weeks. It puts a lot of things into perspective, and the focus at the moment should be squarely on how we can stop the human suffering and bring an end to the war. I sat down with our own Tom Holder and Aidan Connolly to find out what some are doing to help and the impact sanctions are having. First, though, we're going to go to our regular segment, the Retail Rundown, to hear about some of the major stats and trends coming out of the UK retail industry. And now we're diving straight into the Retail Rundown, where we have a look at the latest stats and trends from around UK retail, drawn from our exclusive retail monitors. So let's jump right into things. In February, UK retail sales increased 2.7 on a like-for-like basis from February 2021, when they increased 9.5%. This was below the three-month average growth of 3.5%. and the 12-month average growth of 8.5%. Total retail sales were up 6.7% on last Feb, so that's a good sign, which is also above the three-monthly average, but below the 12-month average of 11.3%. For the three-month period, December to February, we found that food sales were almost unchanged, increasing just 0.1% on a total basis. One of the big movers, however, was the non-food online growth. That was up 26.9%, which is about in line with the three-monthly average. But the penetration rate for that category did drop from just over 65% last February to just over 40% this year. A lot of the numbers we're seeing were, of course, impacted by Storm Eunice and falling consumer confidence. One thing that does seem like it's here to stay is online spending, which now accounts for 4 in every £10 spent. That's up from 3 in every 10 before the pandemic. Turning now to our shop price index, February marked the fourth consecutive month of price increases, with shop price inflation continuing to accelerate. That's driven predominantly by a rise in non-food prices. The index predicts prices will continue to rise, with inflation likely to pick up speed, especially with increasing geopolitical tensions, labor and freight costs, and tax rises. All prices were up 1.8% year on year, with food, particularly fresh food, the biggest mover, up 2.7% and 3.3%. respectively. Finally, looking at our footfall monitor, and bear in mind these figures are compared against pre-pandemic levels, we saw UK retail footfall taking a strong step in the right direction in February following January's slowdown. So total UK footfall reported the highest number of shop accounts seen since the pandemic, and that was recorded in the last week of the month. In terms of concrete numbers, of course, footfall continues to be down against pre-pandemic levels, with total footfall down 14.9%, but that's a 2.2% improvement on last month. High street footfall was down 19.4%, that's a 4.4% improvement. Retail parks down 10%, or just over 10%, I should say, which is a 2.8% improvement. And then finally, shopping centres were down 35.2%, which is an improvement of 2.3%. Still a long way to go then to get to pre-pandemic levels, but a solid step in the right direction. And that's it for the retail rundown. We're now going to move to our conversation with Tom Holder on the situation in Ukraine. I'm joined now by Tom Holder, media lead here at the BRC. Tom, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, thank you.
So today we're going to be talking about the rapidly evolving situation in Ukraine. Tom, I know many of our BRC members are doing their bit to get money and resources to those on the ground who need it. Can you tell us a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a horrendous situation out in Ukraine, and it is at least heartening to see retailers coming together to play their part. We've seen, you know, millions in donations, so some huge ones from Tesco, Amazon, Sainsbury's, Aldi, and other retailers are literally putting in, you know, more than £1 million to groups like the Red Cross, to varying other parts of the disaster emergency appeals. And we're seeing match donations to help people, customers play their part and support. So I know John Lewis, Tesco, Sainsbury's through their Comic Relief are all running match donations, which will add to the existing donations they've made. Many retailers are making donations in kind, often as well as financial contributions. So clothing being donated by M&S, some food supplies by Holden & Barrett, things like nappies and toiletries by Asda. All of this incredibly important to the people of Ukraine who are, you know, suffering this invasion at the moment. On top of that, obviously, a lot of international retailers have stopped their operations out in Russia. That's not just from sanctions. That's because they believe that there's, you know, a moral reason to stop that. All of this will hopefully have some positive impact for the people of Ukraine, and particularly those financial contributions and those contributions in kind, which are there to hopefully make some people's lives that little bit better in this current situation.
Yeah, so obviously, you know, we are talking about a war here. And to be completely honest, during a period where we're seeing so much suffering, retail really isn't, it doesn't feel like the thing that we should be focusing on. But as a retail podcast, I do have to ask the question. We're hearing a lot of talk about how sanctions and also just the situation in general might start affecting prices and inflation in UK and across the globe. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the first thing to remember is that inflation was going up quite steeply even before the invasion of Ukraine. So we were seeing commodity prices going up, shipping prices going up, labor prices going up. And all of this was starting to have an impact on prices on the shelves, both food and of other products. What the situation in Ukraine is doing is exacerbating those pressures, and obviously it is raising some commodity prices, you know, particularly things like wheat or corn or sunflower oil, things that come out of frankly either Russia or Ukraine. You know, the impact will sadly be to put more pressure on prices. Now, retailers are doing their best to try and mitigate, to try and find ways to cut costs and protect UK customers, but you know, it's impossible to completely do that. And we should expect prices to rise further in the coming months. And that's certainly the type of thing which the Bank of England has also said, that inflation is likely to continue to rise.
Brilliant. Thanks for coming on the podcast. Just for a quick one there, Tom, we'll continue the discussion on Ukraine with Aidan now, but thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to come and talk to you.
And I'm joined now by Aidan Connolly of the NIRC. Aidan, how's it going?
Not too bad, not too bad.
So Aidan, today we are obviously talking about the situation in Ukraine. Since the invasion first started, we've seen broad sanctions imposed from the EU, US, UK, and also further afield. First, I want to talk about sanctions on Russia and how this is having a reciprocal impact on the rest of the world.
So firstly, it might be a good idea to kind of explain what sanctions are. I don't think everybody sort of gets what they are. I suppose the easiest way to say that sanctions are penalties imposed on one country on another to stop it acting aggressively or breaking international law. And they are pretty much the toughest actions that nations can take short of going to war. But what we've seen so far are measures designed to cripple Russia's financial system, hurt its wealthiest citizens, and those have been brought in by a range of nations who are opposed to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But in trade, as in physics, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So Russia has retaliated by banning the export of some products. So if we look at what sanctions have already been imposed on Russia, well, sending luxury goods to Russia, including vehicles, high-end fashion and art, has been banned by the UK and EU. The UK will also put a 35% tax on some imports from Russia, including vodka. There's a ban on the export of goods used by Russian firms introduced by the UK, EU, US. That includes dual-use goods. So that means goods that are for use by consumers, normal shoppers, as well as the military. That can be anything, chemicals, lasers, that sort of thing. All Russian flights have been banned from US, UK, EU and Canadian airspace. And the G7 is stripping Russia of its most favoured nation status, which means it'll lose many trading benefits. We're also seeing that there's been targeted on wealthy business leaders who are known as the oligarchs, those who are close to Vladimir Putin. You know, the UK has put travel bans, asset freezes. It's also imposed sanctions on 386 members of the Russian parliament. I suppose the one that people kind of have latched onto is the sanctions that have been put on Chelsea owner Roman Abramovich. There's also things on oil and gas, but we can talk about that later on. So we're also seeing our members, some of our members have reacted to it. So a growing number of international companies, including McDonald's, Coca-Cola and Starbucks, have suspended trading in Russia. And if you look at why they're doing this, there's a report that came out from Amati Global Investors, which said that shareholders simply wouldn't stand for the continued generation of profits from Russia. Now, these sanctions have an effect on the government, but they also have an effect on everyday people as well. And people are starting to feel that economic squeeze. It's had a real big effect on the ruble, the national currency of Russia. And to be honest, this, as I said at the start, this is as close as people get without actually going to war. And you cannot underestimate how much of a squeeze that this puts on Russia. You got to remember, they're facing the same hiked global commodities. Again, we'll come on to it later on. But the same recovery from COVID, the same issues as all of the global markets are facing. And these sanctions are on top of it. So some people said we need stricter sanctions, harsher sanctions. I suppose it'll be a graduated response. The longer this goes on, the harder the sanctions will get. But it looks like the international community really has stepped up to this one.
I said in my conversation with Tom that I had earlier that it doesn't feel like the time to be focusing on retail, but obviously this is a retail podcast, so I have to ask the question. These sanctions obviously going to have an impact in turn on the UK retail market. We can talk maybe a little bit about oil and gas, but what kind of outcomes are we likely to see for the retail industry here?
Okay, I think, you know, it would be remiss of us not to say that first and foremost, this is a human tragedy. For the people of Ukraine, and you know, everything else after that is secondary. But it does have an effect on our ability to trade. And I suppose the biggest advice that I could give retailers, or in fact any business, is to look at your supply chains. There's three buckets that I put everything in. There's direct impact, there's indirect impact, and there's global commodities. And we all talk about a supply chain, but I've been doing some modeling in this past couple of weeks about how we really are affected by the Russian supply chains. And it's actually more like a spider's web. If we start with the direct, there are some things that we get directly from Russia and the Ukraine. Now, that goes straight on our shelves. Now, you know, there's a few and far between. But to me, the main ones are sort of seed oils, rapeseed oil, sunflower oil, that's sort of either high end or lower end. We also get some cereals direct. And of course, you've got your vodkas and that sort of thing. But the real vulnerability really comes into effect when you're talking about the indirect products. So I'll just give you a couple of areas where we need to look at. So about 4% of all of the exports of Russia are those wiring, for insulated wiring. And so your mobile phone, your TV, your laptop probably will have some element that has a bit of Russian wiring on it. There are stocks of those, but the longer this goes on, the more that it is going to impact on people. One of the ones that doesn't really get enough airplay is the cereals. Now, everybody's been talking about cereals for human consumption. The real interesting point is the cereals for animal consumption that then goes to make meat for humans. So if you look at pigs and chickens, about 60 to 68% of their feed will be cereals. And even somewhere as small as Northern Ireland, five out of the past 6 years have needed over 400,000 tons of Ukraine wheat. Now, if you can't get that, there's a couple of problems. So firstly, if you go to the next cheapest, there's tariffs on that and it's more expensive anyway. And that will drive up the price of cereals and therefore drive up the price to farmers, that drives up the price to the end consumer. And that's not a good place to be. The other thing is that a lot of the stuff that we get from Ukraine is certified. And that means that if it's organic, then the pigs or the chickens are organic, which then gives you your 10, 15, 20% premium because people pay for organic foods. If that chain is broken and you have a GMO food that is not organic, then there's real problems. And so there's 15, 20% of the final retail prices is wiped off if it's no longer organic. Another example is manure and fertilizers. This is a really strange one, but really important. So there are three main types of fertilizer. There is your fully organic, which is guano, or the things that animals leave behind them, which is good, full of nutrients, but it is hard to move. It takes up a lot of space compared to other types of fertilizers. The second type is potash. And potash is really effective. And we buy the majority of our potash from Ukraine and from Russia. Now, the big sort of worry on this is that if we can't get it from Ukraine or Russia, the other places are China and other places that we don't really have trade deals with. So really, it leaves us with only one place to get, Canada. And still, that's really expensive to move it from there as well. So the third type is fully synthetic, and that comes from taking nitrogen from the air. To do that, you need natural gas, which obviously is in great supply and going through the roof at the minute, which we'll come on to later on. So we, because of this, sort of we could see sort of maybe start of the summer, we could see that the prices of fertilizers goes through the roof. Also, it means that there is it's more expensive to buy and therefore less of it is, but we don't know if there's going to be enough of it. However, what we've seen in past times is that farmers try to use less. And if farmers use less, there's lower yields. If there's lower yields, that means that we need food or cereals from other places. So it's a pretty vicious circle. But the main thing on this is the main thing on this is for members and whatever business you're in to actually look at the supply chain or the supply spider's web, because it's only as secure as the weakest link, and you have to understand your vulnerabilities. So that's the first two of the buckets, direct and indirect. And then the last one is global commodities, which oil and gas fall into, and you wanted to ask about those.
Yeah, so this is obviously the final sort of major sanction that's now being discussed, which is on Russian oil and gas. It's obviously particularly contentious given the EU's, or certain states in the EU's, reliance on Russian oil and gas. What kind of outcomes could we potentially see here? Do you think it's likely that we see the wider world adopting these kinds of sanctions? And if so, what kind of effects could this have, particularly in regards to energy prices and therefore price inflation generally?
It is not a pretty picture, my friend. The longer that this goes on and the illegal actions of Russia go on, then the harder the sanctions are going to be. And there will be more and more pressure put on other countries who haven't taken those sanctions to do so. Now, that's not without harm to their own consumers. If you look at Nordic 1, Nordic 2 pipelines and that going into Europe, especially Germany's reliant on Russian gas, that's a big thing for them to do, but they are doing it, and that will get more and more expensive. And I really do think that the longer this goes on, the more they will have to squeeze Russia on these sanctions. Now, what does that mean for us? It's not great. You know, we are seeing petrol prices go up daily. And in fact, I saw them go up twice in one day at my local gas station recently. This is not sustainable. It's not sustainable, especially when you are looking at a time when consumers are being squeezed. Even before this, gas and oil prices were going up. In fact, in January, a barrel of oil was 53% dearer than it was the year before. Right? That's sort of a huge leap. Now, retailers are doing a lot and have absorbed a lot of those prices. So if you look at, we've had the highest global commodity prices since 2011 recently. And that's kind of the territory that we're in now. Now, retailers have absorbed a lot of that. So where you've seen a 17 or, even 30% rise in things like sugars, that's not translating into a 30% rise at the tills or on the shelves. But, there's very little wiggle room now because retail is a very high footfall, low profit margin, high volume, low profit margin industry. So global commodities is the real problem. So like I said, the fact that we use, for synthetic fertilizers, we have to use gas. For carbon dioxide production, we have to use gas. The fact that moving things, even before this, the price of moving goods from Southeast Asia to the UK went from $3,000 to almost $20,000, in and around $20,000. And that's, that's completely non-sustainable. And that was before the Ukraine situation happened. So where we are is in a pretty much 1970s inflationary territory when it comes to this stuff. A good way to sort of look at how volatile the markets are at the moment is whether or not you can buy futures. So usually you can buy oil futures or gas futures for a few months in advance. No one is doing that right now, quite simply because they don't know what the price will be and the wholesalers can't guarantee their price. The shorter those futures run is a good tally of how bad the situation. The fact that you can't get those at all shows you how volatile the market is. And the fact that cereal stuff is cereal futures are very hard to come by is again a serious sort of indictment of where we are. So I think it's very much batten down the hatches. It's very much doing what retailers are very good at. It's being adept, being fleet of foot and changing their supply chains. I think there's a big part that we're doing at the BRC is to help people understand what exactly is needed, what exactly will be the sanctions, what we've talked about today, but also how to look at their supply chains. And that, I keep saying this during the podcast, I'll say it again, look at your supply chains. Look at who is supplying you, look at where they're getting the stuff from, look at the whole way down the supply chain, because a vulnerability, if you are the best preparation for any of this, in the same way as it was with Brexit, is to understand your supply chains, understand your vulnerabilities.
Brilliant. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast, mate. Talk soon.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Tom and Aidan there. Moving on now to our discussion with Ali Bristow from Rubla and Patrick Brody of RPC to talk about the upcoming employment bill and what it means for retailers. We hope you enjoy the discussion. And I'm joined now by Ali Bristow from Rubla and Patrick Brody from RPC. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Hello.
Great to be on your podcast.
So today we're going to be talking about the much anticipated employment bill. Patrick, if we could start with you, for listeners that are unaware, can you give us a little bit of background on the bill? What is it? When's it coming? And what are we expecting to see in it?
Sure. It's an interesting question, William. It was in 2019 that the Conservatives, by their election manifesto, set out their proposed agenda for future employment protections. And those then found their way into the proposed employment bill. Now, since 2019, save for consultations on the suggested changes to the law, there hasn't been any formal announcements progressing the proposals. This delay has, as you might expect, been laid firmly at the door of the pandemic, with the government saying that the bill would be introduced when, and adopting their words, the time is right. Now, we expect, but can't guarantee, to hear more about the bill in this year's Queen's Speech. The changes proposed by the employment bill are at their core designed to protect individuals whose employment may be more precarious because they're either economically vulnerable or their current roles don't have flexibility to balance personal responsibilities with work. The changes sought by the bill propose to give workers greater protection in three ways. First, by introducing a single enforcement body to police and safeguard essential rights, including, amongst other things, to holiday pay and sick pay. However, it's worth bearing in mind that it may be some time before this body is set up, albeit this shouldn't dissuade employers from testing their pay and assumptions and processes now. Second, protection is achieved by promoting choice and independence, by allowing workers to balance personal and family life with work. This will be achieved in two ways. First, by introducing a right to request from day one, flexible working. And second, for workers to have additional time off because of a need to care for others, including neonatal care. The third change proposed by the bill seeks to provide greater economic certainty to employees engaged on variable contracts by giving them a right to ask for more stable and predictable employment. In effect, employees who have fluctuating variable income have a chance to swap that for more stable and certain income. And in doing that, helping their longer term personal financing and budgeting. So as said earlier, the changes suggested by the bill are that protect individuals whose employment may be more precarious.
And so what are the main ways that we're expecting the bill to actually impact retailers?
So, William, the regulations proposed by the bill create broadly a floor of rights, in effect, a bare minimum. But at their heart, the proposals describe good employment practices reflecting today's employment trends, which seek to elevate the security afforded to those in employment and also increase the number of people finding employment. Retailers looking at the changes proposed by the bill will recognise that the principles underpinning them also speak to retailers' initiatives to attract, retain, and motivate their employees. This is, in my mind, particularly important in today's job market, where for employers, there's the combined challenges of skills shortages and wage increases driven by inflation, the cost of living, and for some roles, a scarcity premium. So to mitigate costs and potential labor shortages, companies are looking to see if they can do three things. First, companies are reframing the pay and reward bargain by creating benefits outside of pay that will influence employees to join or remain. Flexibility and independence carry significant value, as does the stability and predictability of regular pay. Both are outcomes that the employment bill seeks to deliver. Second, organisations are redesigning more flexible workforce arrangements to encourage individuals who might not consider participating in work because of competing personal family commitments to join. Again, the flexibility of employment encouraged by the bill reflects this feature. Third, employers are looking to describe and create a working culture that celebrates well-being, diversity and inclusion. Again, schemes and initiatives that support the ability of employees to care for dependents or to work flexibly, and which are anticipated by the employment bill, go to the very heart of a company's D&I strategy. Retailers are therefore looking at their good work plan, the Taylor review and the employment bill, not simply to understand the future floor of legal rights, but rather to understand what changes can be made to create a more inclusive and supportive workplace.
Thanks for that, Patrick. Now, Ellie, it's obviously pretty clear that there are going to be some challenges for retailers there. So what can those that are actually listening do now to prepare for it?
Yeah, I think retailers need to ensure that they have the systems and processes in place to ensure that they remain compliant throughout all of the changes. And technology such as Rubler and other solutions helps really keep them ahead of the curve of any legislation changes. So obviously Rubler being a sort of all-in-one workforce management solution focused on shift-based workers, that's really linking in to what Patrick was speaking about of enabling the employees to obviously have more control over the hours that they work, and obviously changing from variable contracts to more stable income, and having a solution in place that really gives the employees control over when they're working and being able to clearly see when they're working will obviously help that. So there's an expectation that businesses may be sort of more susceptible to audits following the sort of single enforcement body, and solutions like ours can obviously help digitalize the records as well and make them registrably available when needed.
And how much urgency is there around this? You know, if I was listening, I'd be thinking, okay, there's going to be some difficulties here, but why should I be acting now and not waiting for the bill to be enforced?
Yeah, of course. I think prevention is always better than cure, especially with things such as sort of naming and shaming and things like that that are going on. So retailers can't really afford the risk of their sort of brand reputation being named and shamed for non-compliance. So especially, it's really important right now in the labour market where it's so competitive, retailers need to ensure that they have an attractive place to work and that really starts with compliance. So getting things in place now obviously helps not make it a sort of urgent change when this comes in and you've got all of that information ready and available.
Yeah, for the listeners, I'd also like to add that if any of this sounds relevant to you, as I'm sure it will to a lot of retailers out there, we have an upcoming webinar that will be explaining everything that we've talked about here in a lot more detail. That's called Getting Ahead of the Curve, Navigating Compliance in 2022. If that sounds of interest to you, you can find a link to the webinar below in the show notes or also find it by visiting brc.org.uk/events. And with that, Ali, Patrick, thank you both for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Will.
Thanks, William.
Brilliant. Cheers, guys. Our thanks to Ali and Patrick there. And if you would like to join the webinar that we just mentioned, you can find the link in our show notes. And that about does it for this episode of Radio Retail. I'd like to thank all of our guests for coming on the podcast. If you want to find out more about the work that we do here at the BRC, you can visit us at brc.org.uk. If you want to get in contact about future episodes, you can get in touch with me at william.madison@brc.org.uk. Otherwise, thank you for joining me once again on Radio Retail, and goodbye for now.